everyone. We're leaning back into BDSM legal issues today with a really interesting interview with our favorite lawyer, Jessa Nicholson Getz. We talk restraining orders, master-slave contracts, and 50 Shades. Take a listen. In the past, you had mentioned something to me that I always wanted to follow up with you on, and that is that you've worked on cases in which restraining orders were filed due to supposed violations in master-slave contracts. Is that right?
So, yeah, I've had a few cases where the restraining orders have dealt with either conduct that was included, you know, so like it would be the contract would say, you know, you agree to shave your legs, you know, this amount of times and submit to this sort of, you know, there were rules about underwear and things like that in one case that I'm thinking of in particular. And when the submissive failed to hold her end of the bargain up, there were actually two, you know, they cross-filed restraining orders against each other as that relationship was breaking up. She alleged acts of physical violence. He alleged that those acts were consensual and covered by the contract.
Wow.
And so there was the production of the contract in restraining order court, which restraining order court is a pretty special place generally. Mm-hmm. Because it's kind of like the talk show aisle of the courthouse. You know, that like everybody is hyped up and a lot of people don't come with lawyers. So there's a lot of back and forth without a lot of regard to the rules of evidence or courtroom decorum. So it's kind of a wild place to go anyway. They also schedule them back to back to back all morning. So it's just like sort of craziness in one courtroom because the duty judge does them for a week at a time. So restraining orders are always a little wild because so many people are there without lawyers. And then when you include sort of the more, you know, sexually explicit allegations and conversations about master-slave contracts, it perks up the attention of the bailiffs and other courtroom attendees.
I can imagine. So, I mean, I'm kind of enthralled by that situation because it seems like it could go one of two ways. It seems like you could either have the case of like a vindictive ex who is the submissive that like has an axe to grind, and so she wants to, you know, get back by saying he hit her, even though that was their sort of typical play. But I can also see this guy, and in the scenario, I'm assuming the woman is the submissive, but that's not always the case.
That was true in this, yeah.
Oh, okay.
In this particular case that I'm thinking of, the woman was the submissive, the male was the dominant.
Okay. Because I can also see him being this bad guy that, like, beats the crap out of a girl, and then he's like, oh, well, you know what? I have this contract here that, like, basically allows me to do whatever I want, and so you can't touch me. So I can see both sides. Like, I don't know where the truth would lay.
Well, and there was actually a criminal case that was out of the northern part of Wisconsin. It was not my case, but there were videos of what either was pretty horrific sexual abuse or was sort of lifestyle BDSM consensual behavior. And, you know, the defense in that case was all of this was stuff that we had agreed upon and had negotiated. And here, that got a lot of local coverage. And the guy was ultimately convicted, got like 45 years.
Wow. 45
years. The jury rejected the idea. Yeah. I mean, and it was multiple counts of sexual assault, substantial battery. But that was the heart of the defense, was there were these videos that appeared to depict painful sex. And he said, look, this was all consensual. This was all within the realm of the boundaries we had negotiated. None of this was something that she wasn't a willing participant in. You can't tell that from the video, but that's because we're role playing and it's supposed to look like that.
Oh, my God.
You know, and that, I think, is pretty, and like I said, that one wasn't my case because my contact with the master-slave contract was in a restraining order situation. But, you know, you do have to wonder, like, boy, if there's not a lot of documentation of agreements, if they're mostly oral between couples, which I think a lot of people do. I know that there is an art to sort of the written contract as part of negotiations and that lifestyle. But, you know, I mean, if people are just doing it orally and then things go wrong in that relationship, there's a lot of room for accusations that probably have at least some ring of truth to them. You know, because maybe one partner was more or less comfortable with that type of relationship or with taking it a little further than the other one was. And so then somebody started to feel coerced into engaging in that behavior. You know, that I've heard accusations like that a number of times, that it's, well, yeah, I was a willing participant, but I really didn't feel like I had any other option.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't know how you sort that out after the fact.
I mean, so how were these matters that you're talking about resolved? You mentioned that the case that was not your case, he was found guilty. The jury didn't buy the fact that this could possibly be consensual, and he received 45 years. What about the restraining order case that they filed restraining orders against one another? What happened there?
Neither restraining order was granted.
Oh, okay.
So the judge basically said, I think this is a relationship that had very particular quirks. I think that both of you, to a certain extent, are credible about how that worked. I think that the story has changed for both of you as the relationship has changed and the way that you reflect on the relationship. And I'm going to instruct the two of you not to see each other again, but I'm not going to issue injunctions against either party.
Okay.
Which was a fair way to resolve the issue.
Right.
You know, just say, just leave each other alone.
Wow. Yeah. Was that the only case that you had for restraining orders with like really controversial or complicated or BDSM related issues?
Well, that was the one that the written contract was actually produced, and that was the most intense. I had another case where it was a workplace relationship, and there was no written agreement, but the allegation was essentially that it was sexual harassment versus a role-playing BDSM sort of dominance, humiliation, instructional relationship that was going on between coworkers.
Right.
So I handled that as well. It wasn't as clear cut as like, the first case I'm talking about had like a 12-page written contract.
Wow. That sounds pretty thorough.
So that one was pretty intense. You know what I mean? Like it covered how long somebody's hair was going to be and what people were going to eat and how, you know, I mean, it covered everything.
And was that entire contract read in front of the court?
No, not the entire thing. Just relevant portions.
Wow.
So, you know, I mean, it was really that was about to be a bad pun. The thrust of it was sexual abuse.
Right.
And so the parts about the sexuality rather than some of the more lifestyle, less traditionally sexualized things were what were discussed in terms of the clauses that were relevant. But there was a lot of stuff in there that just had nothing to do with the restraining order that was quite specific.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's why they use BDSM negotiations as sort of like the gold standard for consent, right? Because it gets very specific.
Yeah, because you get to, I agree to wear heels that are not less than 3 inches, but not more than 5 inches. And, you know, like,
yeah,
which is very specific.
That is.
That I can tell you, man, lifestyle submissiveness would not be for me.
Oh, no.
It would drive me crazy having somebody trying to dictate like how tall my shoes were, or how often I vacuumed.
Well, what about if you wanted to dictate how often they vacuumed and how tall their shoes were?
You know, like, I mean, I got to tell you, and this is just like a personal thing. I'm all for kink. Like, I love being open about sexuality. I love having great dialogue about sexuality. I would not want to be a lifestyle practitioner on either side of that. Recreational is probably a different question for me. Mm-hmm. But the lifestyle, you know, I mean, my husband is a coworker of mine. He's my best friend. I love that we're equals and that we're partners. And I wouldn't want to live in a structure, role playing or not, that didn't acknowledge that equal nature. But now that's very different than what you want to do for a few hours on a Friday night.
Right. Totally.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that.
I do. I do. I think we're on the same page, too. Something that strikes me about lifestyle practitioners who are the dominant is just that looks really exhausting. Like, doesn't it look like a lot of work on that end to have to monitor and decide all the time?
It almost feels. Yeah. And I have to tell you, like, I understood in season one of Deliberations why they kept coming up with parent-child analogies.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I struggled with the idea that somebody had an unequal actual balance of power. I mean, it certainly looks like that because that's the role that everybody's playing. But I understood how they got to parent-child relationships because it did feel like the dominant was just dictating things. And that would feel like having a child, not a partner, to me. But then that's clearly not my lifestyle orientation either.
Right.
And if it works for, you know, I'm not knocking anybody's decisions in their lives, because if it works for you and it makes you feel, you know, loved and protected and safe, then I think that's awesome.
Yeah, I actually understand the lifestyle submissive role more, because it sounds like, oh, isn't it lovely to like not have to like make every decision and to check in and feel like someone's kind of watching over you. Like I can tap into like why that sounds so appealing. But the lifestyle dominant role, like, that just looks like you're signing on for a lot of work. And again, this is just, it could be my laziness speaking.
Well, you know, for me, like, I mean, when I'm in a courtroom, you know, I'm a lioness. Like, I'm constantly dominating. You know, I mean, there's a whole theory of cross-examination that is just titled Dominate Your Witness. You know, I mean, there's a lot of work on being a controlling presence in a courtroom. You know, I mean, I'm very conscious. Like when you and I talk, we're just having a conversation, and I have a very conversational style in court, but like, you know, you can't see my body language. And that's something that is quite relaxing to me about podcasting versus telling stories in a courtroom context, is I am a somewhat frenetic person. And I really had to learn how to, when making an argument, use the room and stop and talk in one place and then walk to another part to indicate a transition. Like, you know, just the idea, like, I think about how one of the most tiring things about trial for me is having to be so in control of everything that's going on at such a fast pace for, you know, 8-10 hours a day, to then have to go home and do that for the rest of the day. Like, when I get home, I just want to chill out. You know, I don't want to be telling anybody anything.
Yeah. Well, I hear that's why they, like, a lot of, like, people with high-powered jobs, they tend to prefer the submissive roles, because they get that, you know, they get to come down from that sort of...
And that totally makes more sense to me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I think it's totally badass when I hear the women that talk about being dominance.
I think
they're really cool stories, but it just would be, it would exhaust me.
Yeah. I applaud anyone who takes that on, because that looks like a lot of energy expenditure. I wanted to follow up. You said that you also did a restraining order in which there was workplace harassment alleged, and that took place with like oral agreements about kind of consensual BDSM power dynamic play. How did that go?
The court also did not grant that injunction.
Okay.
Which, you know, that's actually very odd, because in our state, all you need to do to get an injunction is show reasonable grounds that somebody has committed an act of bodily harm against you or is likely to do so in the future. Mm-hmm. So the way that our restraining order statute is written, it actually takes a lot of the question of consent out of it, because the question is it reasonable to believe that you may be in physical danger? And there's not really, you know, one way to be in physical danger is to be battered, which does require that happens without your consent. But there are a number of other sort of enumerated things that constitute an act of domestic abuse. And some of those don't require a lack of consent. And so it's fairly easy to obtain a restraining order. And I think there are some good reasons for that. But it's somewhat unusual that in both situations, none would be granted, even though there was probably pretty arguably, even if it had been consensual behavior, there was still probably stuff that fit the legal definition of domestic abuse.
Right.
And, you know, I guess I would sort of speculate that perhaps part of that is lifestyle bias.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, maybe that's judges sitting and listening to this stuff and thinking, well, if you've engaged in this behavior, you're not really capable of being victimized by it, which would certainly be an unfair conclusion. But I can understand that maybe that's at play there.
Right. Oh, God. And I can, too. And I certainly hope that's not the case. It sounds like it very well may be. And that's really sad. That's like, you know, kind of drawing a parallel. That's like saying a prostitute can't be raped, right?
Like, right, exactly. You know, that I think that there might be some element of like, well, if you signed up for this at any point, then that's on you.
Right.
And obviously there's a huge difference. I mean, I don't know. And I'm about to just out myself as having read a truly embarrassing thing. But did you read the 50 Shades of Grey books?
You know, I tried more than once. And I got to a part in the first book, the farthest part I got to, and I was like, I can't read anymore, which is they're having a dinner. It's not even a sex scene. They're sitting down at dinner, and Grey, Mr. Grey, whatever his name was, he was like teaching her how to eat an oyster. And he takes an oyster and he tips back his head and he slurps it down and he goes, mmm, tastes of the sea. And
crackerjack writing right there.
I was listening to it on audio. Maybe that made it worse. And I was like, I can't keep going. I really wanted to keep going to like understand like the book series and everything. And I had nothing against the book series conceptually, but I just couldn't get past the writing.
Well, everyone, so lots of people told me like, oh, you have to read these because you can voir dire on it. Like you can talk to your jury about 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah, and that's true. I see the value in that. Yeah.
So
how'd it go?
Oh my God. All right. So first of all, I was flying to Napa for a girls' weekend and had this. And every 5 minutes on the airplane, I'm just sighing deeply. And my girlfriends are like, just stop reading it. I'm like, I can't. I have to get through it. Because it's so top. This is like right when it came out. I'm like, it's so topical. I'm going to have to talk to juries about this. I need to have read the books.
Right.
Like, I can't just ask questions out of school here. I need to know what these people are reading.
Yes.
So I did read them. And it was alarming to me, the lack of understanding of the difference between domestic violence and a BDSM relationship in those novels.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, it's not okay to put GPS on your partner's car to track their movements, whether you're in a BDSM relationship or not. If you don't tell the person you're doing that and they haven't consented to that, that's fucking creepy.
Okay.
Number two. When you sit down to do your negotiations and she's like, no butt stuff, hard limit. And he's like, we're just going to roll right past that.
Oh, that happens?
Oh, totally.
Oh.
He's like, no, I'm not going to respect that. I'll have your ass. Like, and I think he says it just like that. Like, it stands out to me.
Oh, no.
I'm like, all right. And then, of course, he was like horribly sexually abused as a child, because why would anyone ever be into BDSM unless they had been horribly abused as a child? You know, like,
right. Of course, you need that really dark backstory in order to like this stuff.
You know, so there were just like so many, in addition to the fact that I think people that write the ingredients to cereal boxes have a more refined writing style than those novels. In addition to the poor quality writing, just the lack of connection with actually understanding the community was really difficult.
Yeah, I've spoken to some BDSM practitioners, and I would say everyone that I remember speaking to about it has had a very negative opinion about those books. And I'm not trying to alienate any part of my audience who likes those books. I'm not trying to be a dick. Like, that's awesome. If you like it, go, you know, that's great. And I'm sure that there's a lot of really valuable content in them that I didn't get to. But I will say that one of the things that actually bothered me about BDSM practitioners turning up their nose at those books is that I remember a conversation in which they were saying, oh, as soon as 50 Shades comes out, everyone's going to want to like practice BDSM, and it's going to like, you know, we'll have the bachelorette party, you know, crew trying to like pick out whips and floggers, and this is our thing. And I remember BDSM practitioners felt very territorial about their community and very kind of not inclusive. It felt like sort of an exclusive protective instinct to like to shun the people that were part of that mainstream Fifty Shades culture.
And I think I get that in that, you know, I wouldn't want people who are just being exposed to my community for the first time to think that I existed in that community because of childhood trauma.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty loaded assumption to place on somebody's sexual preferences. You know, I mean, you're making a lot of assumptions there.
Yeah.
And I certainly wouldn't like to be thought of as a domestic abuser or a stalker, which I think Christian Grey comes off as both.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds creepy. Like I didn't know either of those examples from the books. But
and so I'm like, that's reading this, you know, and also like let's just be real. No woman just like has an orgasm 10 seconds into her first sexual experience.
Yeah, I remember because I did start the book, and I remember her just in my, sorry if I'm remembering this incorrectly, but in my mind's eye, she's this like virginal, super gorgeous college graduate dancing in the kitchen in her underwear. I'm like, this is the ingenue? Like, she of course has to be virginal, right?
Like she's like, you know, like the entire complaints are like, she's like, oh, I have these huge blue eyes. And I'm just like so naturally tall and thin. And you're like, God, yeah, just being a 6 foot tall blonde with naturally slim legs is just rough in America today. Like, and you were just too pretty to get laid in a college bathroom somewhere like the rest of us peasants.
My life is just so confusing and hard.
Right. You know, I mean, okay.
Yeah. and then her virginal, her the moment she loses her virginity is just climactic.
It's just perfect. Yeah, it's just like the second that starts, it's just absolute orgasm.
Fireworks.
Yeah, ecstasy. Which everyone who's ever lost their virginity knows is totally true.
Yes, it's beautiful and magical for every single one of us. Well, assuming that I have had sex, which I'm not copping to at all.
I think the ship sailed on that. But no, you know, I mean, it's like I'd kind of like to cross-examine 50 Shades of Grey about its assumptions.
Yeah, no, that I would love to hear a whole analysis of the entire trilogy from like BDSM practitioners. That's got to be a thing somewhere.
I'm sure it is. Somebody has to have been. Because, I mean, I obviously have contact with this community professionally, and just knowing what I know about it from my professional work, I was pretty outraged. Where I felt like it was a really unfair representation. And I agree. You know, like, there's some good things. See, now I feel the need to backtrack on that a little bit. But I think it's always really good when people are exposed to something that they might not be familiar with or be comfortable with.
That is
like,
true.
Like, I'm supportive of that.
I am as well. And I'm also happy with how well received it was and how open suddenly people were to exploring alternative lifestyles.
Right. Like, I think that is important, you know, and maybe that didn't come in the type of package that I would have liked to see it come in, and maybe it was a failed effort in some respects, but it did do some important things in terms of letting people access this sort of material in a way that I don't think popular culture had really tackled to the same extent as that book did, or that series of books.
I agree. I remember speaking to someone recently about how BDSM typically was always presented in a very negative, dark light in media. You know what I mean? And SVU or whatever, it's always this like shady, or it's this really like kind of grungy dungeon that like people escape to in the middle of the night to get their, you know, and it's not really that dark and shady and scary and dirty and grungy. Like, you know, it can be something else entirely. And I like that the book kind of destigmatized BDSM to any extent.
I think that, you know, so like, I do think that was an important thing to have happen.
Yeah.
I just, like I said, I have some quibbles with the execution.
Well, yeah, me too. Like, it's for the record, it's never okay to track someone's locations without their knowledge.
No. That is, listeners, that is stalking behavior. That is a felony in Wisconsin, everybody. Yeah. Wisconsin listeners.
Wisconsin listeners, don't do that. In fact, no one do that.
If you do, though, you can call me. It's fine. I won't be nearly as judgy.
So switching gears slightly, your podcast is amazing. It's called Getting Off. For people who haven't listened to it yet, you absolutely have to. It's so good. It's entertaining, but so informative. And if you love Jessa, which I'm sure you do, you're going to love this podcast. How's it going so far from your perspective?
It's good. We have to, so we've got to figure out how to clean up our audio because I'm louder than Nick is. So we've got to do something with that. But I've got a couple people who have offered to help with that. So hopefully in short order, that'll be working. And then we did accidentally delete a portion of the second part of our Brack Turner series. So we're going to re-record that. We're going to re-record that and try it again. And then I've learned something about backing up things while editing.
That's so, okay.
So, you know,
I've screwed up so many times in this process. So I think you're killing
it. That makes me feel better because I'm just like, what the hell is going on? Like, why can't I grasp this? Like, I'm not that old. This isn't that hard.
I've had two podcasters reach out to me, Brooke Giddings and Forrest Burgess from Astonishing Legends. And they were both like, hey, do you need some maybe? I remember after my first Skype interview, Brooke's like, hey, do you maybe want some tips on how to record remote interviews? And Forrest Burgess actually gave me a tip that sorry if there are any sound geeks out here, I'm totally off the map, but it's called Levelator, and I'll talk to you about it after this interview, and it can help adjust sound levels, because God knows that's where I got a lot of my negative reviews in the beginning of my show airing, were volume issues.
I mean that's pretty consistent with, you know, my negative reviews in actual life too are my volume issues. So it's a critique that is familiar, at least.
Remind everyone how to find Getting Off.
Sure. It's available on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher and through Audio Boom. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook at Getting Off Pod. And the email address is gettingoffpod@gmail.com. We have both a Facebook discussion group and a fan page set up, and we love hearing from you. It's so much fun. Like, Nick and I we've been having so much fun, like, seeing people's comments. And we're so excited that you guys think it's interesting when we talk about cases. And when we were recording the first part of Brack Turner, it was really pretty funny because we had like a 45-minute conversation about everything we had learned before we started recording, because we just were so excited to tell one another about it.
Oh.
And we realized that we were like, oh, we probably should have recorded that. Like, people might have found that interesting. You know, like, what it was that we were just like, oh, my God, did you read this?
You know what, though? So that shines through. Your passion and your enthusiasm for the subject matter and legal issues, like, that, it really does come across when you guys are speaking. So it's,
you know, so we're having fun. So, you know, anyone that wants to listen to us have fun, that's awesome. We love that.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to be continuing to post about it and listening myself. And in the meantime, we've got one more interview next week.
Yes.
Are you in?
I am.
She's in. Thanks for listening, everyone. In 2 days, we're releasing part one of a group interview with the Samantha Hall jury. People can finally hear what these actors' real opinions were, as well as what their experience was actually like arguing with our fellow performers inside the deliberations room, and what the public reaction was like for them after the season aired. Cough, cough, Carl. Please stay tuned for that. Only 2 more Wednesdays to go before our holiday break, after which we're returning with a fresh trial in January. Thanks, everyone. See you in 2 days.